member of the Unacceptables. My mind is malignant.
Today, I open up my book for all to see. The words I speak are mine alone today.
Yes.
No offenses, no pretenses, just poetry.
Welcome to Griot Science. Only the scientists know how to get that perfect entanglement. The kind that makes friends with entropy, then drops it. It's a sacrifice that must be made. Packaged as dreams hopping into a control reality, 1, 2, 3, no, not just smooth perfection. A severe deforestation. 4, 5, 6. How close. Sleepy is to death.
So, I am here with Joseph Felton.
Hello!
So, Joseph Felton is a postdoc here at University of Texas in Dallas. He did his PhD.
Also here?
Also here at the University of Dallas.
Well.
Joseph, can you tell us more about how your interests have evolved as a scientist?
So, once upon a time, I was a little kid, and I wanted to be an astronaut. Then I found out I was colorblind, and then I realized I can never be an astronaut. So, like, second choice for me was to be a guy, a scientist, that made solar cells. I did my PhD on solar photovoltaics. And, you know, energy and all the other stuff. Because for me, even, you know, when I was still late teens, early 20s, I was like, okay, the linchpin of everything else around us in our society is based upon how much power we got. Juice, electricity, you know, thermodynamic go from burning fossil fuels. It all comes back to energy for, you know, everything else. It is the enabling, call it the enabling reagent for literally everything else. Without a whole lot of power and electricity, a whole lot of power, you no longer have leisure time, you longer have a chance for everyone to, you know, have a, you know, an extended childhood like we have in the first world, where no one expects you to be useful until you're 18, 21 maybe, rather than being put to work on the farm, right? And that was kind of an important life lesson, because my mom grew up with the no running water or electricity thing going on. So, like, how cool that was that I could be a child for, you know, 2 decades was not something I took for granted. So I was always fascinated with the idea of, you know, how to make power, how to produce more of it, and how to do that. And so from, you know, finishing my PhD, I went on to work in the Department of Energy, which right there, right in the name, energy. So, yeah, a lot of it, though, like, for those of you who, like, don't follow government agencies too closely, the DOE's primary job is actually to babysit the thermonuclear warheads and other nuclear bomb stuff. I mean, it does do research on wind and solar and nuclear power and all that stuff, but it's always must-get-done job is make sure these things are in good repair and make sure that they work when they're needed, hopefully never. So that was a part of what I did. And I didn't feel too conflicted about that part until, gosh, 2017, when they announced that they're going to revive the W-76 program and make new nuclear warheads, which is right around the time I decided it's time to walk away, and I came back to UTD and do research here for kind of similar things of organic light-emitting diodes, but it's kind of an energy economy, or economizing on energy, rather than producing it. However, I'm still trying to do, like, write up research grants proposals for things on that I think would be useful for producing more power, more energy. It's still kind of that common theme to how I do research and how I approach it. So, yeah.
I see. So, it seems that you were kind of interested, I mean, aside from the astronomy, you became interested in the energy sector for the sheer necessity of it. But what strikes me the most is especially considering the whole thing going on with climate change and our resources running out, energy, natural energy resources running out, that there is more focus on things like, as you say, babysitting nuclear warheads, you know, and less focus on how we might sustain ourselves with nuclear energy in the future.
It's a crying shame. Everyone wants. Everyone looks at nuclear power and nuclear energy and says, "I could get political concessions out of my neighbor, rather than I could use this to, you know, power my town or power the next, you know, 5 dozen towns." It's it's a lot of juice packed into tiny little rocks to boil the water, which is all it really is. It's basically boiling water.
The things that scientists see that the rest of us don't. Very interesting. But aside from that, it's this whole... I mean, we live in an age right now where at least some of us in some parts of the world have things, you know, at excess, at convenience, and at luxuries, you know.
You can say it. A lot of us are just kind of fat. From
including energy.
Stored energy? Right along my midsection? Yeah.
No.
It's all right. It's all right. I enjoyed every single bite.
I mean, as much as a scientist who would go into the energy sector with, you know, the desire to find ways and, you know, methods to produce more energy for society, would you say that there is as much or attention being given to, say, the distribution of energy or how energy is being used and why? You know, is there an ethics to that...
Absolutely not. We give away our ethics of like how or why or should we do this or this or this to, we defer it completely to the market forces, which is, well, what are market forces? It's whoever has the gold makes the rules, right? It's only slightly removed about above the old joke about whoever's got the guns make the rules or whoever has the spears makes the rules. Instead of like a, what is the most important for everyone and what is the second most important and how do we rank these things and blah, blah, blah. I mean, the only way that we determine priority of what we spend our energy on is purely money, and that's not equally distributed. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, I don't know if there's truly a we in that distribution. There is, you know, several dozen people who have a lot of decision power, and then literally everyone else. Mm-hmm. There may be several thousand people who have a lot of decision power, and then everyone else. So that's veering into politics and away from science.
Yeah. Well, clearly you have, you know, a good understanding of the market and how things are run in industry. And as a scientist yourself, I mean, you leaving the energy department is testimony to the values that you hold as a person. Are there other ways, or are there ways in which you have, as a scientist, vocalized these opinions that you have, or the concerns that you have?
I mean, professionally, no, because I'm kind of I'm not a person who's like, you know, been in the field for decades to express these opinions.
But is this something that even scientists who have been in the field for decades feel is their place to speak about?
Some do and some don't. Like, there's no one, like, prototype of what a scientist is or isn't. Some are in it for, you know, because they've been good at it. They've been good at being a scientist they've been good at doing the science classes since they were a kid. And, well, I guess I'll, you know, continue doing chemistry, and then I'll continue to get a chemistry PhD because I'm so good at it. And what do? Well, I guess I'm a professor now. Mm-hmm. Like, some people don't introspect, I suppose, as to the why they do it. They just kind of be like, well, I'm good at this. It's the old, I have a hammer, where are the nails kind of question, right?
Right.
And, I mean, I have easily fallen into that trap for up until maybe right before I started graduate school in the first place is, well, I'm good at science and I'm good at engineering. I guess I'll go to undergrad and be a scientist and engineer. And, you know, I don't think it was like a conscious process of what do I value? What do I, you know, what can I do? What are my talents at? So it's, some will speak up, some won't. Some will speak up against it because they believe it to be wrong or they believe it to be right. They, you know, the only thing that holds scientists together is that we all have an agreed upon set of rules for how do we conduct ourselves and how do we communicate information to each other to determine what is, quote, real and, quote, not real in terms of, you know, information. Now, the whole philosophy of what we have is just a bunch of ground rules.
So going into the, well, the whole things that define what a scientist is, like you said, there's obviously a lot of variation. There's a lot of, you know, individuality from one scientist to the next. However, at the end of the day, what makes a scientist is how they conduct experiments, how they validate them and such things. One of the things that interests me as a, you know, a prospective graduate student in science. I did study physics, but like you say, it's a maturity that develops over time, the whole identity of the scientist. But yes, the boundaries of science is one of the things that has interested me as a scientist who's also an artist. And it's strange to say that because, of course, every scientist is also something else, a musician or historian as yourself.
More of a consumer of history rather than a chronicler of it. But
yes. Sure. What interests me is those gaps in which other disciplines can get into science and influence science, how science is done, what kind of science is done, how we think of science, you know, things like that. So one great example is from a publication or a paper by John Moore, where he talks about how the science education at a higher education level is focused on such things like, they call them the hard sciences, whereas other things like the history of science or the ethics of science are considered soft science that, you know, non-scientists taking electives would take, whereas the scientists themselves who need to know such things, you know, they don't take such things.
Yeah, they don't care.
It's not encouraged.
You can point to like specific events in history, like say the depredations of Unit 731 or Joseph Mengele or something along those lines.
I have no idea what that is.
Oh, okay. So Unit 731 was a Japanese research division for basically how do you take people and render them into kui messes chemically. Like, you know, spray them down with this chemical, how quickly do they die, you know, flamethrower test subjects, vivisection, stuff like that. Similar story from Mengele, but with less proper bookkeeping. Both of them were ultimately, like, both of them 100% evil sons of bitches. Two, they also kept shoddy records. So what the value of the research is extremely questionable even before you even start the ethical questions.
Yeah, I remember as well there was this the whole time when lobotomizing people was a thing.
Oh, as a treatment for...
As a treatment for psychiatric disease.
Yes.
These things are terrifying. But
right. And now we think that we're more civilized with transcranial magnetic stimulation, which maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. I know that it exists and that it has helped some people. But whether or not it's like a universal good, whether or not there's some, you know, consequences down the road, I don't know. I assume that we have gone through ethics reviews and mm-hmm. boards of people for these ethical reviews, but mm-hmm. it's not my yes, field. But I'm pretty sure that they
definitely
had to go
through
that.
There's a huge like regulation, especially with the you know the FDA and stuff.
Yeah,
there's much consideration for these things.